Shows like Power Rangers, Voltron, and Adventure Time masquerade as children's shows, but have garnered huge adult cult followings owing to their deep themes, sneaky comedy, and richly drawn characters. And today's animated pilot, Buddy Thunder, fits perfectly in that tradition, so stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
Gentlemen, welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network for the Unproduced Table Read. This is a show where we read Hollywood's hottest unproduced pilots and features. And today we are reading a very imaginative and surprising animated comedy, well, animated adventure show called Buddy Thunder. If this is your first time tuning in, I think I mentioned it, but we read Hollywood's hottest unproduced pilots and features. We will be interviewing our writer, Steve Andriolo, who wrote this pilot later in the show. He's calling in, so we're super excited about that. But before all of that, I would love to introduce our cast. Andrew, let's start with you.
This song is sweet.
It is.
I just
want
to say that really quickly.
This is actually from a video game
called
A Hat in Time that I love very much.
A new workout mix. Hi, everybody. I'm Andrew Guy. And today I'll be reading for Toshiro, Washington Hubble, and Cinder.
Hey guys, I'm Roxy Stryo, and today I'll be reading for Whipple, Cantaloupe, Godfrey, Ticketmaster, and Barkeep.
What's up, guys? I am Timothy Michael, and today I will be reading for Esteban and Buddy Thunder.
Hey guys, I'm Adrian Snow. I'll be reading for Lieutenant Ort, Zeke Beams, Magna Centauri, Virgil Bits, and Jetta Star.
Hey everyone, my name is Sheldon White, and I'll be reading for Alistair Ong, Radial Jones, Loudspeaker, Newscaster,
Name them all.
Announcer.
Name them all.
There's a lot of them. We're going to have some fun.
I like bringing in our guests and just giving them like 50 roles. So as you guys could hear from those names, this is a very unconventional pilot. But at the same time, I do think it's borrowing from the mythologies of movies like Star Wars and sort of a lot of adventure-driven children's shows, and I think there's a lot of imagination really undergirding the development of a narrative like this, so I'm really excited to get into it. Basically, just so you guys know, we will be following a young boy named Buddy Thunder who is on a quest to find his parents who abandoned him, is the general premise of this show. So there's a lot more to it, and with that, I say we get into it. Guys, this is Buddy Thunder, Beyond Earth, and the pilot is called A Dream Burned. Interior, cockpit of Rift Runner. Thunk! A fist hammers the side of a hollow radio currently broadcasting static between its antenna. Toshiro, a 16-year-old kid with a rough Votech good looks, pushes back the sleeves of his Galactic Academy uniform.
Come on, this is important.
The hollow radio buzzes and the static clears. An old woman demonstrating how to knit appears.
There we go.
Toshiro picks up a pair of knitting needles and gingerly works yarn between them. Esteban, thick-skinned, big-boned, and just pushing 50, steps into the cockpit.
What are you watching?
It's called An Evening at the Yarn Barn. This woman, master knitter.
How exciting.
Hey, it's all that comes in way out here.
You shouldn't even have this on. We're supposed to be listening for radio signals.
Esteban turns his attention to some monitoring equipment.
Right, you mean the wild goose chase the Academy's got us on.
You enrolled to be a sponsored explorer. You knew the deal.
Risking our necks on the edge of the solar system listening for signals isn't exactly what I had in mind.
Toshiro holds up his knitting, which is not much more than a partial sleeve. He peers through it at Esteban.
Maybe I can knit us a wormhole back to Earth.
Esteban knocks away the knitting.
Cut that out. The Academy is just trying to stay competitive. It needs ears everywhere in order to be on the leading edge of discovery.
Esteban tweaked a few dials and flipped some switches.
Cutthroat edge of discovery, it seems like sometimes.
Listen. The faster we get this data, the faster we can sail home.
Esteban reaches out to the holo radio's dial. The entire ship goes dark.
Hey! She was just about to show a new stitch!
Well, I didn't do anything.
Esteban and Toshiro huddle around a porthole. A comet-like object whizzes through space.
What was that?
Esteban turns back to the console.
Not sure. All the instruments are dead.
Suddenly, stars blink out all over the spacescape.
Esteban?
A boiling blackness churns in the distance. It grows as it approaches and fills the porthole with darkness. Interior, Galactic Academy Day. Washington Hubble, a diminutive kid in a white lab coat, walks down a bustling hall of the Galactic Academy. His intricately mechanical glasses, made from dozens of moving parts, hum and whir. He holds a large textbook whose title reads, Falling Upwards, An Anatomy of Spacefaring Vessels. Small mechanical arms extend from his glasses and turn the pages as he reads.
I don't know how Buddy makes sense of any of this.
In one quick motion, Alistair Ong, a fellow cadet at the Galactic Academy, leaps up onto a railing that descends a staircase. He grinds down it on his feet and leaps off. The collision detection alarm vibrates on Washington's glass, and he moves just in time to avoid colliding with Alistair.
Well, people have died doing that, Alistair.
Oh, they have not.
Well, then it's only a matter of time.
Relax, Washington.
Alistair walks away. Up ahead, a chattering group of young prospective cadets walks down the hallway, led by Lieutenant Ort, a young lean officer. Washington steps to the far side of the hallway to make room for the group. The group stops at a display case. Lieutenant Ort stands beside it. Inside, a handful of old star charts, worn photographs, and a dozen small artifacts lines the shelves. Whipple, a young cadet with large eyes and a broad smile, presses his face against the glass.
What's all that stuff?
Lieutenant Ort taps the side of the glass, and a light illuminates the inside.
You'll see displays like all this around the academy. This one contains artifacts from Dash Thunder's early deep space expeditions.
Who's that?
An explorer who made a lot of groundbreaking discoveries. We would know far less about the solar system if it weren't for him. Now then, down this hall is a mix of residential faculty apartments, dorms, and a few labs.
Washington walks past the group of cadets and down the hall. He approaches a door with a sign that reads Dash Thunder hanging crookedly on it. He knocks.
Buddy, you home? We're going to be late for class. Again.
Interior, apartment of Dash Thunder. Buddy Thunder, a skinny kid with dark eyes and tousled hair, sits on a couch with his lift deck laying hover coil side up across his knees. The logo of the lift deck manufacturer, Star Coil, is barely visible, the relief worn away after so many writing sessions. Clothes, lift deck magazines, and schematics litter the living room of the apartment. Pictures of his father, Dash Thunder, with other explorers, faculty, and administrators line the shelves. Buddy rummages through the mess of the on the coffee table and grabs a screwdriver. He tinkers with one of the hover coils that makes his lift deck hover. He powers it on and off, watching closely as the coils hum and emit a flickering green glow.
Oh, that should be steadier.
He picks up a small journal inscribed with his father's name. Strange glyphs wreathe the edge. Buddy flips through the journal, and as he does, fantastic animals, detailed star charts of deep space, and a sketch of a strange city or ship flash by. Another knock. Reverberates throughout the room.
Riding my lift deck would be easier if class didn't get in the way.
Interior Galactic Academy, Washington stands outside the door.
Buddy.
He flicks on the thermal imaging setting on his glasses. Through the door, a red, orange, and yellow silhouette of Buddy springs up from the couch and dashes to the window, lift deck in hand.
Not again.
Washington flings open the door. Interior apartment of Dash Thunder. Buddy sits perched on the windowsill, a knapsack strapped to his back, his lift deck under his arm, and his Galactic Academy uniform crumpled in a ball on the floor.
Hey, Washington! I was just off to class.
You're not even... You're skipping again, aren't you?
The Atom Games are tomorrow. It's the biggest lift deck competition of the decade. I need to practice my run.
What you need to do is go to class. You're going to get yourself expelled.
They wouldn't throw me out. Would they?
My dad said he heard other faculty people talking about it.
No way. My dad put this academy on the map.
I don't know. It's just what I heard. Look, please just take class more seriously.
I just don't want to be an explorer. I don't need to know what's out there. I'm good right here with my lift deck, but I will for you.
Washington slumps down in a chair.
Thanks. You know, I really think you'll find enjoyment.
After tomorrow, bye.
What?
Buddy drops from the windowsill. Washington rushes over to it and sees Buddy fall 50 stories. Exterior Galactic Academy. As Buddy drops, he spreads his arms and legs to slow his fall. A gauge illuminates on his wrist and clicks away the meters as he descends. 125, 75, 25. With only a few meters left, Buddy shoves his lift deck under his feet, stomps on the switch, and zooms across the grounds of the Galactic Academy. An illuminated model of the solar system hangs above a fountain that dots the center of the courtyard. Cadets sit around, buried in textbooks and leisure reading. A security enforcement official walks the perimeter. Buddy blasts into the courtyard on his lift deck. The hover coils chug with energy, and Buddy grinds the ledge around the fountain.
Hey, you can't ride that here. This is a quiet zone.
The security enforcement official dives for Buddy, but Buddy jets off the ledge. The security enforcement official splashes headfirst into the fountain. A young cadet sitting nearby looks at the SEO and puts a finger to his lips.
Shh!
Buddy zooms through the Andromeda Annex. The long, curved spires of the Galactic Academy arch into the sky. He glides past the bus stop where cigar-shaped hover buses slowly descend and dock. Cantaloupe Godfrey, possibly the last of an alien race of Nolems, with shoulders 6 watermelons wide and skin the color of melon rind, swoops beside Buddy on a small hover cycle that seems barely large enough to support him.
Hey, Cantaloupe.
Hey, Buddy, what are you up to?
Practicing my run. Going to try a switch side slide that... ledge at Carina Junction. Can you shoot it for me?
Happy to.
Buddy tosses a small recording device to Cantaloupe. The ledge, seemingly stretching out endlessly, looms in the distance. Zeke Beams, a cadet in Buddy's rank with spiky blonde hair, a red jumpsuit, and a lift deck, like a slice of gold fire, appears on Buddy's flank.
I call that ledge, Zeke!
Call it owned by me, because I'm going to grind it first.
Zeke stomps the switch on his lift deck. The hover coils whir with energy, and Buddy does the same. Buddy pops onto the ledge first, kicks his lift deck hover coil side up, and slides down it. Behind him, Zeke pops onto the ledge and grinds it. He rockets down the length of the ledge and loses control. Wham! He crashes into Buddy and sends them both tumbling. Zeke lands in some nearby bushes, and Buddy recovers in midair, just getting his lift deck under his feet, and he slams into the ground. His rear hover coil smashes into the tilted walkway. Buddy tumbles forward off his lift deck. Cantaloupe cruises up to him. He dismounts his hover cycle, which transforms into OEO, a small robot with eyes like cathode tubes. Cantaloupe helps Buddy up.
Thanks.
OEO, can you check on Zeke?
OEO runs over to Zeke a few feet away.
Get away, I'm fine.
Buddy walks over to Zeke.
That ledge was mine, dude. Now I've got a busted coil.
Well, just because you're Dash Thunder Sun doesn't mean you own every ledge and lift deck spot.
That has nothing to do with it.
Whatever. With any luck, you'll abandon the academy and never come back. Just like him.
Buddy angrily rolls up his sleeves on his shirt. Cantaloupe puts an enormous hand on each of their shoulders and gently massages them.
Let's all just calm down. Fighting won't solve anything.
I get that frying pan you call a hand off me.
Beside Cantaloupe, OEO's eyes glow red.
It's okay, OEO.
Forget it. I had to go to class. You should try it sometime, Thunder.
Zeke retrieves his lift deck and jets away. Buddy holds up his lift deck to examine his rear hover coil.
Great. The day before the competition, too. I can get some off to radials. You want to come?
I would, but I've got a politics of inner ellipse exam later and need to brush up. About all I know right now is that the inner ellipse is made of Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. I think it might go into more detail.
Alrighty then. Catch you later.
Exterior, Outer Limits Lift Deck Shop. The Outer Limits, a small rickety lift deck shop, hovers a few stories above the ground. Two large birds perch on the edge of an awning. One takes flight, and as if in response, the shop bobs a little, its neon sign flickering. Two elevator tubes extend up past its wraparound porch. Tools, modifications, and lift decks clutter the antiqued but well-stocked shop. Buddy pulls a hover coil and a blister package from a pegboard. Insert blister package. Particle, giving you more lift for your thrift since 2256. A crash explodes from the stockroom. Radial Jones, a heavyset man with worn, thick hands, emerges from a cloud of dust in the stockroom.
Hey, Radial? Everything okay back there?
All good, my friend. Here for some new mods? I just got some kill thrust exhaust in that will make that old deck of yours hum something pretty.
Busted coil, actually. These particle coils any good?
Yeah, they're all right. Probably not worth the 50 max or whatever I'm charging.
Radial leans across the counter.
That reminds me. Come here.
What?
Just come here. This is top secret stuff.
Radial pulls out a worn set of hover coils from beneath the counter. Buddy picks them up.
Came across these today. Timely, I'd say. Meant to give them to you a while ago.
Buddy picks them up to examine them.
Well, these are pretty heavy. Bad shape, too. Well made, though.
Yeah, and I've never seen a pair with so much lift.
What brand are these? I don't see any etching.
They were something your dad built, actually. So, they're yours.
Buddy gazes at his reflection in the dented, chrome-plated coil.
Hey, you knew him pretty well, right?
Sure did. Back in the day, I was a bit of a celebrity with all those deep space expeditions with your dad and Rick Venture. Of course, your dad's still as famous with all his other discoveries.
Infamous, you mean? You think he did find some treasure out there and hid it from the Academy?
The old rumor mill grinding away at you again?
I guess so.
A lot of strange things out by the fold. That old anomaly, I hear, but no way.
Well, how can you be so sure?
That just ain't him. He was about sharing what he found. He never cared for money or fame. I don't know what happened out there, buddy, but I know he'd never abandon the Academy. Or you.
When's the last time you saw him?
Well, now that's a tough one. I had stopped adventuring with them even long before you were born. Then I was out of touch for a while, had some things to sort out. When I finally returned to set up shop, you were here, and neither your dad nor Rick Venture were.
So you can't really say for sure that he didn't abandon us.
I can, though. I know your dad. I know what drives him. The kind of person he is.
You talk like he's still around.
Because I know he is.
And my mom?
You know no one knows who she was.
Yeah. I just wish I knew the truth sometimes, you know?
I hear ya. I wish I knew why my wife was so gassy all the time. But answers don't just fall from the sky. Hey, this will take your mind off things. Check this out.
Radio grabs a flyer from the top of a stack. A bunch of others spill to the floor.
Reps from Everlift were here and asked me to post these flyers.
Insert flyer. Everlift sponsors will be on site at the Atom Games scouting for new local legends. Buddy swipes the flyer from Radio's hand.
No way! Everlift?
They're big time.
The biggest? Man, to get sponsored by them would be, like, out of this world.
I know it. And hey, try not to focus on whispers and rumors.
Yeah, thanks, Radio. I'll try.
Exterior, Lift Deck Park, site of the Atom Games. Matt Ricks, a cadet a rank above Buddy's with a jet black hair, rockets across the course toward a loop that ends in a ramp. At the crest of the loop, his lift deck stutters. Matt eases up on the lift deck switch before tilting into the descent. He stomps on his switch at the height of the ramp and launches into the air. Matt aims for a rail suspended in midair, but his lift deck falls from his feet. His arms windmill before he grabs onto the rail. Cantaloupe, OEO, Washington, and Magna Centauri, a thin, tall cerulean with deep blue skin, watch from crowded bleachers. Washington struggles to see above the standing spectators.
Did you see that?
I can't see much of anything.
I didn't think Ricks could miss a trick.
Put your glasses on.
They're always on.
With one hand, Cantaloupe picks up Washington.
Hey, what are you doing?
Cantaloupe sits him on his enormous shoulder.
If you think I'm going to sit up here like some parrot, forget it. It's degrading. Wow. It's actually a pretty great view from up here.
Look, Buddy's up next.
Across the park, on the floating starting platform, Buddy taps the switch on his lift deck. The hover coils on his deck energize and de-energize. In a booth at the top of the bleachers, an announcer pulls a microphone close to his mouth. Two antenna on top of the booth transmit replays of the action.
Next up, Buddy Thunder.
Buddy walks to the edge of the platform and dives off. He pulls in his arms and legs to gain speed. At the last second, Buddy slides his lift deck under his feet and whooshes across the course. Two ramps flank a vacuum trap. Buddy soars up the first ramp and over the trap. His lift deck shudders. Buddy eases up on the switch, grabs his deck, and somersaults before landing on the receiving ramp. The crowd roars. Buddy speeds up a quarter pipe and blasts off into the air. A gravity gap, a sphere with a strong gravitational field hanging 20 feet in the air above the quarter pipe, pulls Buddy up and over it. Behind him, points of bright light dot the sky. Buddy spins his lift deck as he floats over the sphere and back onto the course. He rockets toward a steel helix. Just before reaching it, he kicks his deck and flips hover coil side up. He braces his insteps against each hover coil, his shoes softening from the heat. The lift deck slides along the helix. He flips the back deck, jams on the switch, and powers toward the loop. Buddy flips his deck again and slides along a rail that lines the squat loop, and the crowd gasps. Buddy travels to the crest of the loop before flipping his deck. He eases onto the switch. The hover coils chug with energy. Washington, Cantaloupe, and Magna cheer. Buddy blasts off the ramp, kicks the lift deck to his hands, catches and spins it before throwing all of his limbs out spread eagle. The lift deck spins and rises with him. He stops the deck from spinning, replaces it to his feet, and slides along the elevated rail. Buddy grinds to the end of the rail and jumps to the starting platform. Cheering rings out from the crowd.
What a run! Who's up next?
Just Zeke is left.
Across the course, Zeke clambers up the ladder to the starting platform.
Nice run, Thunder. Now watch a real rider.
Next up, Zeke Beams.
Zeke drops down from the platform, his gold lift up like a slice of fire under his feet. The hover coils energize as Zeke drops. He zips toward the first ramp. His lift deck hisses as he jumps the vacuum trap. His lift deck smacks against the landing ramp, struggling to regain his balance. He cruises toward the quarter pipe. A shard of debris streams through the air and hits his lift deck, knocking it away from his feet. Zeke tumbles forward.
Yes! Buddy's got first for sure now.
Wait, I think something hit him.
Washington's glasses magnify the action. A larger piece of debris falls from the sky and explodes upon hitting the quarter pipe. The crowd flinches and begins to flee as more debris rains down on the course.
Wow. I don't know about you guys, but I'm out of here.
Magna joins the fleeing crowd. A pod covered in tarnished brass, copper plating, and adorned with strange glyphs streaks through the sky. A small cosmic turbine propels it toward the ground. It crashes into the quarter pipe.
All cadets return to the academy by order of Commander Bites.
Buddy leaps down from the starting platform on his lift deck and rejoins Cantaloupe, OEO, and Washington.
Everyone okay?
If you can be dirty and still be considered okay, then yes, I guess.
What was that thing?
I don't know, but I'm going to find out what just ruined my chances of riding for Everlift.
Buddy zooms toward the pod on his lift deck. Cantaloupe hops into the air and OEO converts to a hover cycle just before Cantaloupe lands on him. Washington rotates a lens on his glasses to magnify the pod.
Wait, guys, I think I can get a reading from here.
Just
so
Cantaloupe picks up Washington and they cruise to the pod. Buddy stares at the pod as Cantaloupe, OEO, and Washington approach.
Buddy?
Look at these markings.
What do they mean?
Buddy pulls out his father's star chart journal and pages through it.
I don't know, but I've seen them before in my dad's star chart journal.
Buddy clambers up closer to the pod.
What are you doing?
Seeing what's inside.
Buddy burns his hand on the hot cockpit.
Ow! Oh, it's melted shut.
Washington flips on his thermal imaging.
I can't get a reading. The heat is overloading my sensors.
We need to find out where it came from.
What we need to do is get back to the academy before we get in trouble.
But what if it has something to do with my parents?
A hover van cruises onto the course. A group of security enforcement officials, followed by Virgil Bites, commander of the Galactic Academy, with a buzz cut and shadowed cheeks, and Leonard Hubble, a science professor that looks like an older version of Washington, walk onto the course. The SEOs fan out. Virgil and Leonard pad toward the pod.
Well, so much for not getting in trouble. My dad's here, too.
Is there any way we can figure out where it came from?
Sure. We can let the Academy handle it and see what they'll tell us.
Washington, please. I need to find out the truth once and for all.
Your parents are alive and well, Washington. I know mine are gone. We have closure, but Buddy doesn't, and life can be tough without it.
Well, I'm not touching the thing, but if you guys want to get a sample of the space dust, I might be able to trace where it came from.
Yes!
Washington withdraws a slide from his glasses and tosses it to Buddy.
Hurry!
Buddy scoops some space dust from beneath the lip of the turbine guard and tosses the slide back to Washington. Washington inserts it into his glasses, and a status bar flickers on the lens.
Anything?
It'll take a minute.
I don't think we have a minute.
Virgil and Leonard, flanked by a few security enforcement officials, approach the pod.
Washington, this is very unsafe of you.
Virgil waves one of the security enforcement officials over.
Get that hover van over here and quarantine the pod. Lock down the entire area. Cadets, return to the academy.
Not until we find out what this thing is.
Buddy holds up his father's star chart journal.
What do these markings mean? Does this pod have something to do with my parents?
Buddy, quick scan shows the dust doesn't track anywhere in the inner ellipse.
It is none of your concern. An artifact of a lost culture, perhaps. No more and no less.
Well, where did it come from?
I don't know.
Then why the lockdown?
Merely precautions. Now leave or face expulsion.
Well, charting the fold, your father found evidence of a great civilization.
Mind your rank, Hubble.
Look, he has a right to know.
I'll decide what he has a right to.
But where is he now?
One more word, Hubble.
We lost contact long ago. All that was left was just...
I said enough.
A security enforcement official seizes Leonard from behind and covers his mouth.
Dad!
Your father was greedy and with discovery, buddy. The expedition consumed him. I'd caution against a similar greed.
I just want to find out what happened to my parents.
The Academy has moved on. So should you.
Leonard struggles free from the security enforcement official's hold.
Go! All of you, just run!
Security!
The security enforcement officials close in on Buddy, Washington, and Cantaloupe. Cantaloupe leaps onto OEO and picks up Washington. Buddy grabs a hold of OEO's fender.
Cantaloupe, tow me up to the pipe, to the gravity gap.
Cantaloupe stomps on OEO's accelerator and tows Buddy up the pipe. At the top, Cantaloupe veers away as Buddy launches into the air. As he soars over the sphere, he somersaults and hand plants to the sphere. He stomps on the lift deck switch and the hover coils thrum with power. The large sphere dislodges from its delicate balance and rolls down the pipe. The security enforcement officials scatter. The spheres gain on them, bowling them over and attracting them to it with its strong gravitational field. With most of them stuck to it, it rolls off into the distance.
Yeah!
Not the way I would have done it, but...
That'll be okay. Let's go.
And exterior Hogue Station. Hogue Station dots the center of a shadow valley.
If we were going pod chasing, we need to get off this planet and out of the inner ellipse.
Overhead, a serpentine chip emblemized with the word laser train along the side eclipses the moon. The pneumatics wheeze as the segmented ship curls into a spiral and touches down on one of the chrome landing pads that tile the valley floor. Interior Hogue Station. Hogue Station bustles with activity. Inside, the vacuous halls radiate out from the center of the station toward different landing pads. A huge stained glass dome comprised of thousands of individual windows spreads over the hub. The staining, colorful and nebulous, suggests celestial bodies in deep space. A loudspeaker shrieks the names of destinations.
Now boarding Hayline Line to Pepperdine Station.
Buddy looks around.
So many people.
So many off-Earth germ-carrying hosts.
The lenses of Washington's glasses tilt left and right, highlighting dirty spots on dozens of different people.
Earth is becoming a popular place, even for middle and outer ellipsers.
Small blue and orange text flickers on the lenses of Washington's glasses.
What's that?
Full scan analysis of the space dust from the pod.
Washington pulls off his glasses and rubs his eyes.
What's wrong?
Washington puts them back on.
Well, it's pretty far out.
Like rad? Far out?
No, like distance. Residual chemical composition analysis points to beyond Pluto.
Holy Soleil. How do we even get there?
Cantaloupe walks up to the map of the solar system flickering between two antennae extending up from the floor. Dozens of colored lines mark laser train routes between the planets. Cantaloupe's finger traces a line on the map.
Looks like we can take the express to Jupiter and then hop a local train to Uranus. After that, I'm not sure.
We'll figure it out once we get there.
Near the entrance to one of the boarding platforms stands a small kiosk. The word outbound flashes above it. Buddy, Cantaloupe, Washington, and OEO get in line. In front of them, a burly man in a leather overcoat steps up to the ticket master. He grunts before snatching his tickets and hobbling toward the outbound terminal. They approach the ticket master.
Three tickets to New Juno, Jupiter, please.
Ha! Trains aren't running out that far.
But they're on the station map.
The ticket master leans forward out of the kiosk, knocking his hat against the lintel. It slides off his head, revealing thin, wild, wiry hair. He gestures to a large holo radio broadcasting across the terminal. An image of a clean-cut newscaster fades in and out between its antenna.
Stay tuned for Madrid World's broadcast. He'll examine the vanishing celestial bodies of the outer ellipse and beyond. What's making them disappear? Some deep space maelstrom? Some dark denizen?
It's gotten bad. Whatever's out there, it's swallowing stuff whole, messing with navigation.
Well, we tried.
Is there any other way?
You could try hitching a ride on a ship. Best bet's the Rusty Nail spaceport, if you can handle it.
I feel like he said that in a way that maybe we should not try it.
I'm sure it's fine.
It's our only chance.
Buddy, Cantaloupe, and OEO run out of the station with Washington trailing behind.
I'm just saying, nothing good ever comes from Rusty Nails.
Exterior, Rusty Nail Spaceport. The Rusty Nail Spaceport hangs in Earth's stratosphere. Rickety docks radiate from a few buildings, beat-up trade galleons, brigs, fluits, and a dozen other docked ships bob on their tethers. Curzon Defoe, a fat, dwarfish alien with a sharp nose, stands on the dock near a sleek sloop of war, with the name of Weenu emblemized on its side. The hatch of the Weenu opens. Jetta Star, a tall, slender female with platinum hair and a blue-black spacesuit, walks off the ship, a fractured amulet dangling from her neck.
Ah, Jetta Star, always a pleasure to see you.
You lie about as good as you smell, Curzon.
Curzon sniffs each armpit.
I call that scent the spaceport special. Now what have you got?
Jetta unwraps a large shimmery rock.
What's this?
It's from Titan.
Curzon examines the rock.
It's a rock.
A rare rock.
It's junk.
Hey, I risked losing my ship to a chiral volcano to get this.
Well, maybe you need to risk more. I've got guys lined up to sell me middle ellipse garbage. Maybe it's time you find a new line of work.
Curzon hobbles away.
But I...
See me when you discover something good.
You watch, Curzon. One day you won't be able to turn on a holo radio without hearing my name.
Across the way, air whooshes inside one of the tubes that extends from the planet's surface to the spaceport. Thunk! Washington, Buddy, and OEO shoot out of one of the tubes. The tube groans as it struggles to move Cantaloupe up the length of the tube. He tumbles out onto the dock.
They need wider tubes.
Or thinner cantaloupes.
I come from a big bone, people. What can I say?
Jetta watches as they enter the cantina. Interior, Rusty Nail Spaceport Cantina. The doors to the cantina swings open. Buddy, Cantaloupe, Washington, and OEO step inside. Smoke wafts through the air. Old sailors, some missing eyes, others missing limbs, huddle in the dark corners of the room. Laughter intermittently interrupts from parts of the room, intermixed with foul language and the occasional punch. Washington pulls off his glasses and looks around.
What are you doing?
With my glasses off, it's harder to see the scary.
Relax. We have Cantaloupe. Who would mess with us?
The only thing Cantaloupe would be good for in a fight is finding a cat to pet.
Pets, not punches.
At the bar, a barkeep alternates between wiping down the counter and filling glasses with different drinks. He flips a glass, places it on the table, and spins it. A small hover coil activates underneath it, and the glass floats a few inches above the bar. He pours a pale yellow liquid into the glass and then pushes it down the length of the bar to Cinder, a cerulean with a beard as blue as his skin and long, raven black hair.
I lost at least a half a mark's worth of drink with that little show.
So lick it off the bar.
Cinder grumbles and downs the drink in one gulp.
Maybe the barkeep can help?
Cantaloupe, OEO, Buddy, and Washington walk up to the bar, and the barkeep eyes them suspiciously.
Don't be causing trouble now, especially the big one. I've heard stories about Nolums can crush a man with one hand behind their back and won't hesitate to do so.
It's not like that.
Yeah, heard that one before, too. People come in here all the time with the best intentions. Next thing I know, I got a hole in my wall.
The barkeep gestures to a patched hole in the wall. Beside it, the door to a cantina swings open. Jetta Star saunters in and shoulders in between two sailors at the bar.
Barkeep, I'll take a Milky Way on the rocks.
The barkeep fills a glass with ice, pours a drink over it, and dips a small antenna-shaped stirrer in it. The end of the stirrer fizzles and pops like a tiny sparkler.
We're just looking for a way to get to the outer ellipse.
In the safest way possible.
Ha! You hear that, Bibato? These kids fancy themselves deep space explorers.
Bibato, an old sailor huddled over a pint, takes a swig of his drink while chewing on the end of an empty pipe.
Trust me, you ain't gonna get far without accurate charts, and they're near impossible to come by these days.
But there are train routes out that far.
Yeah, but outside of those established routes, it's risky sailing. Only the most experienced sail out that far. With everything that's been going on, there's even less sailors taking that chance.
What if we've already got charts?
Bibato laughs so hard he tumbles from his stool. He peers back into his pint and tosses it on the floor and clambers back onto the stool.
Right, and I'm emotionally stable.
But he pulls on his dad's star chart journal and flashes a few pages.
Let me see that, boy.
Bibato flips through the journal. He gazes at the name Dash Thunder on the cover before snapping back to reality.
Even if those charts are real, you won't find someone crazy enough to sail out there anymore.
Jettastar bumps into Washington.
Oh, excuse me.
Spoke too soon. Barkeep, another round.
Bibato turns back to the bar.
If you guys are looking to sail beyond the inner ellipse, I'm your gal.
You? You're like 15.
I'm 16, and you're only shot.
How much?
Buddy, she's 16. We need a seasoned explorer, you know, with a beard and a pipe and a sailor's cap, lots of wrinkles.
All right, then. Take your pick.
Jetta waves her arm to take in the rest of the cantina. Grizzled, tired old explorers stare back at them, grit their teeth, and look ready to eat them alive.
You can't always judge someone just on looks, Washington.
No charge.
This is a scam.
What's in it for you?
A closer look at those star charts.
Buddy looks around the cantina. Sailors quiet down and listen more closely to their conversation.
Okay.
Great. I am the soon-to-be-famous explorer, Jetta Star. You can call me soon-to-be-famous.
How's that?
Because I'm on the verge of discovering something amazing.
Like what?
I'm not sure exactly, but I'll know it when I find it. You've read the history books, right?
Like which ones?
I don't know. Any of them.
I guess. Have you?
No, but that doesn't matter. What matters is that one day you'll see my name in them, and that's the point.
Okay, buddy.
You can sail, right? I mean, you actually have a ship and everything?
Of course. And I'll try not to be insulted by that question.
Jetta looks around the Rusty Nail. A few sailors begin to gather in a posse.
And I think we better get to it before this crowd sobers up enough to realize you've got those charts.
Sounds good. I'm Buddy. This is Washington, Cantaloupe, and Cantaloupe's Weenbot, Ioio.
Ioio's eyes flash in response.
A pleasure.
The five of them walk toward the door of the cantina. Jetta turns around as she talks.
Wait until you see my ship. She's a beauty.
Two large men and a woman gather in front of the exit.
Jetta?
Seriously, there's nothing I'm more proud of. Modified sloop of war.
Jetta reaches her hand out to push through the doors of the cantina when her hand meets the belt buckle of Gustavus, a huge man more fat than muscular, with the torn sleeves of an old Galactic Academy uniform tied around his head as a bandana, and a missing forearm replaced with whatever he could find lying around. Jetta spins around.
Well, you're not the door.
Nope. Gustavus.
Gustavus crosses his arms.
Saw the boys showing off some deep space star charts. Heard they belong to Dash Thunder. I'm thinking them charts might be pretty damn valuable if that's the case.
Is that true?
Yeah.
And don't think that big friend of yours is going to scare us.
Listen, I'm sure we can all work this out.
Shut it! Hand over the charts and we'll make this as painless as possible.
Do it, buddy. You heard him. Painless.
Oh, excuse me. Gustavus? Or Gustavus, was it? Do you know who I am?
Everyone knows who you are, Jetta. The most unsuccessful explorer of all time. A first-class failure.
You're wasting your time. I've got something more valuable right here.
Jetta pulls out a large, shimmering rock she tried to pawn off to Curzon.
What's that?
Only a rare sample of titanite.
Washington looks at Buddy and mouths, titanite? Buddy shrugs.
See how it shimmers. Go on, look!
Jetta holds the rock out. Gustavus steps forward to examine it. And at that moment, she slams it down on his foot. Gustavus screams, falls to the ground, and clutches his toes. And Jetta vaults over him.
Come on!
OEO transforms into a hover cycle. Cantaloupe and Washington hop on and rocket around Gustavus and through the doors. But he leapfrogs over Gustavus and, before reaching the ground on the other side, pulls out his lift deck and lands on it. The remaining sailors all dive at him at once. He slams on the switch and shoots out of the cantina and down the dock. The sailors slam into each other. They race down the dock towards Jetta's ship, its curved hull resembling the contours of a humpback whale. Space barnacles adhere to its engine casing. A gangplank extends from the ship to the dock. Jetta runs over to the ship's tethers, heavy taut cables.
Go, go, go!
Jetta waves them up the gangplank.
No time for formal introductions. Boys, the we know, the boys.
Buddy, Cantaloupe, Washington, and OEO pulled up the gangplank. On the dock, Jetta pulls out a small radio tuner. Gustavus limps out of the rusty nail, followed by an even larger posse.
Jetta!
He hurls the rock towards her, but it falls short. Jetta dials in a frequency on the radio tuner and knots twisted around the cleats relax. She pulls them off, and they retract back to the ship, which drifts away, creating an ever-widening gap between the gangplank and the dock. Gustavus and his posse charge after her. Jetta leaps for the gangplank, gets one hand on it, and hangs there as the ship backs away from the dock, but he runs back down the gangplank and pulls her back up.
Thanks.
No problem. We do still need a pilot, after all.
Come on, let's get inside.
Jetta picks herself up and leads Buddy through the hatch and onto the Weenoo. They turn around to see Gustavus shaking his fist at him. Interior, bridge of the Weenoo. On the bridge, control panels, levers, buttons, and monitors of all shapes and sizes line the walls. The ship's helm, a wheel made from polished obsidian, rocks back and forth.
Okay, in case of an emergency, here's the hierarchy of importance. Me, my ship. My ship again. You're a weenbot. Then you, and you.
OEO gets priority over us?
He's already proven himself more useful.
We'll be fine.
How can you be so sure all the time?
Buddy walks up to a large window overlooking the bow of the ship. Far below, the Galactic Academy sprawls across the surface. The Outer Limits lift deck shop hangs in the air, a small flickering speck. In one fluid motion, Jetta discharges a bunch of levers, flips some switches, and spins the wheel. Buddy watches out of the bridge window as the ship veers away from Earth. Cantaloupe and Washington stand beside him.
I'm going to Miss Radial's shop.
Think of all the mods he'll have in stock by the time we get back.
Who knows? Maybe we'll run into some other lift deck riders on the way.
Cantaloupe and OEO both stare at Washington.
Hey, I can be optimistic. Occasionally.
I hope this isn't a wild goose chase. I hope we find something.
I think hope is a great place to start.
Exterior space. The Weenoo careens away from Earth and lumbers toward Mars. A small satellite with Galactic Academy etched on its side whizzes by, its lens trained on the Weenoo. Interior, the office of Virgil Bites. Virgil Bites stands in his office. In front of him, a static-filled image of the Weenoo cruising away from Earth dances between the antenna of the holoradio. A security enforcement official stands beside him. Virgil adjusts one of the dials to clear the image.
Post a bounty for their return. And I want the Academy's task force sent to find them.
Yes, sir.
And at no point should it be revealed to Buddy Thunder that his mother was in that pod.
Understood.
The security enforcement official walks out of Virgil's office. Fade out. Yay. Interesting. All right, guys, we're going to take a 5-minute break and get Steve on the line so we can talk all about this pilot. Stay tuned. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Unproduced Table Read. We just read the pilot, Buddy Thunder, Buddy Thunder Beyond Earth, the pilot titled A Dream Burned, written by Steve Andriolo, who is in New York. Steve, we are so happy to have you today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. No, you guys did an incredible job with that read.
Thank you so much. It's such an imaginative pilot, and I think I want to start by asking just really what inspires you, because one thing I can say confidently was we haven't really read anything else like this on the show.
Yeah. Well, with this particular project, so I had kind of started conceiving this a while ago, and Star Wars has been a big part of my life, and I was really big into Star Wars and Harry Potter at the time. And this actually started life as a children's book. I had taken some children's literature classes in graduate school and wanted to kind of do something in the Star Wars, Harry Potter vein. And that's kind of how it got started. And then I was reading this book called Bud Not Buddy, which is this fantastic children's book about a boy looking for his father, and it's set in 1939 against a backdrop of the Great Depression. So that also kind of inspired it. And at the time, I was on a cross-country trip driving across the Great Plains, and it was just miles and miles of straight road. And that's where I kind of started thinking about this character, Buddy Thunder, and what kind of journey he might take.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I see you're an MFA lit major, and I'm wondering if, like, kind of Campbell's hero's journey is influencing the way you write. I feel like writers are always talking about this.
Yeah, and it's hard not to think about that, and so much so that in the conception of this, I have, as I plotted and outlined, you know, I've had Campbell's journey in a document and kind of mapped out how that might fit the story and stuff like that. So that certainly has played a role for sure.
It's interesting. I feel like whenever we're talking about classic narratives, even old and new, it's hard for writers not to talk about Campbell's journey. For any listeners who don't know, Joseph Campbell was sort of a scholar who developed a very, very specific paradigm for how great epic stories are told. And I'm wondering how you rely on that and lean into the conventions of that, but still sort of make a project your own. Just because I do think so often we hear writers talking about this, but also requiring specific developments that separate them from just a retread.
Right. That's a great question. I think with any of my writing, the biggest challenge or bit of advice and something that's always helped me, and I actually started as a poetry major, so even back when I was writing poetry, is just not to try to shoehorn things to fit a specific mold. So even if I'm looking at the hero's journey, and even if I'm looking at a diagrammed out, I'm not trying to force the story too much into that. It helps to have it as a guide, and it can help you get out of sticky situations, I think. But just, again, using it as a guide, and if the story doesn't want to adhere to those markers, then to kind of let it go where it wants to go. I think that's key when you're writing, and even with, and same thing goes with theme or anything else that you're trying to approach, is just, you know, let the writing go where it wants to go. This sounds so nebulous and artsy, but
it's good
to kind of let it try to be as organic as possible and not really try to fit it to a specific mold.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and one of the most interesting choices that you make in this pilot, is not necessarily holding the reader's hand when you introduce the mythology of your world. So you'll say something like Lifdek and just let us kind of discover what it is as if we were the viewer watching the show, whereas some writers would let us know Lifdek hyphen a Lifdek is a hoverboard a la Escape, something like that. So
right.
Why did you decide to sort of make that? Why that choice?
Why the choice of kind of revealing details like that in that way?
No, so more so why the choice of not holding the reader's hand as you introduce the mythology of your world?
I think that kind of, well, one, I think that's be kind of boring to read. And there was a lot more of that in earlier drafts. This was, as I said, this was a children's book. Then it was a feature length script, a very long feature length script before I put it into a series. And there was a lot more of that in originally, and it started to sound very technical and boring. And I thought, you know, the cliche, I guess, is there, you can say as much with what you don't say than what's on the page necessarily. And, I thought I could, you know, I just wanted the reader to kind of fill in those blanks. I thought there was enough there for them to fill in the blanks themselves and discover what that stuff is. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, I have a detailed backstory about every bit of whatever that appears in this. And over time, I've slowly been backing that stuff out and trying to put more faith in the reader to figure out what that stuff is.
I would love for you to tease some of what's coming up, because another choice you make in this pilot, which is a bold one, is I think you don't reveal necessarily a lot of what we will be seeing in this show. So this is a twofold question. One, what are some of the maybe plot details that we'll be seeing later in the season? And two, how did you decide what to reveal to us and what to withhold from us?
So the entire series is outlined, and you can actually read it on my website. I have the, in addition to the pilot, I have the entire Bible there, which will outline every single, there's 22 episodes in the first season.
Wow.
And there's pretty detailed summaries of every story beat along the way. But the cool thing about having it as a series was, you know, essentially Buddy and his friends are on a journey across the solar system. So, along the way, it's about, you know, Washington learning to be a little more confident, and Jeddah, we learn a lot more about Jeddah and who she is and where she comes from. What was your original question?
No, that's a great question. I was just curious about which plot details we'd learn about. And
so,
was there anything that you withheld from this pilot that you considered letting us know, or which details did you maybe decide to include or not in earlier drafts?
Not really. The pilot, way back to when this was a feature length, this was kind of act one of mm-hmm. the feature length. And I always thought it worked as a pilot, a good jumping off point. And I wanted to kind of end where it was because I wanted it to be a moment where Buddy was at this point where he's at his dream, you know, the lift deck competition. It's the biggest competition of the decade. He's been practicing his whole life for it. And then it just gets destroyed. And now he's seeing this connection to his parents that, you know, that he didn't really want to have to think about anymore. So that just seemed like a natural launching off point to the rest of the series. And by the end of it, by the end of the first season, every question that's brought up in the pilot, you know, right down to what that burning black churning thing in the little prologue scene there, we find out what that is. We find out Jeddah's backstory. We find out more about Cantaloupe in Washington and Buddy's parents. And a lot of that came from the original backstory that I had charted out a long time ago. And there is it's interesting in the pilot how little of the original backstory and where Buddy actually came from. It's interesting how, how little of that is in the pilot. I mean, it's really over the course of the series that you learn all that.
Yeah, and it's super interesting how you do like mention the parents a few times throughout the script. What made you decide that was like, that's kind of the driving point of the whole show? It feels like after the end of the pilot is like figuring out the story behind everyone's parents, mainly mm-hmm. Buddy's. Why did you choose that as the driving point?
That is a great and hard question. And I honestly don't know how it ended up being that. I guess each of these characters, I think, is a little bit of me. You know, Washington's OCD, Cantaloupe's pacifism, Jeddah's kind of funny sarcasm, Buddy's wanting to just kind of, Buddy being afraid of going outside of his boundaries. So I guess, on some level, maybe getting to know, and actually Buddy's mother wasn't really in it too much, at all originally, but maybe a part of it might be from my own, wish to learn more about, my parents and where I came from and that sort of thing. So I think that's kind of where that came from.
Yeah, it's cool. I find it super intriguing. I have like an estranged father. So I think that like when you talk about things like that and someone just kind of wanting to figure out where they come from, it's an interesting plot device that you barely even mention throughout the pilot, but it is enough at the end to be like, all right, I need to know what's going on. His mom's now in the picture, you know, so I just think that's a very interesting way that you did that.
Steve, you do a really amazing job at immersifying the reader into your world, and obviously that speaks because you did all this planning in your head. Were you ever worried at any point that the reader would be lost on all the technology and all the I guess, sayings that you use?
Technical jargon?
Yes.
Which I think is why I've tried to dial it back, and I also hope I've chosen a lot of the terminology is stuff I invented, mostly because I liked the sound of the words. So that is a concern. And I hope that the, you know, what's happening, you know, the lift deck is a skateboard. I hope there's enough of that kind of thing, in there, You know, I hope there's not enough of an attachment to what people are familiar with to help anchor that. But, you know, I did, like I said, I did try to stay away from being too technical and more. I just like the sounds of the words, holo radio. And I liked, I don't know how well it comes across, but I did. I've always kind of liked this sort of retro futuristic thing. I like the chunky clunkiness of technology to some degree. So I tried to convey that through some of the words and technology.
Have you ever seen the movie Treasure Planet?
The Disney movie?
Yes.
I have not.
Okay, and I know that's what I was getting from and, this. That's how I followed the technology, if I'm going to be honest.
What's that?
I said that's how I followed the technology, to be honest, because it was pretty not similar, because yours is a lot more detailed, but that's what my frame of thought went to.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I have not seen all of Treasure Planet, but I've seen enough parts of it to definitely see that.
And speaking of like the universe you've built, I think this show kind of fits into an interesting legacy of recent shows like Steven Universe. Or, like, I kind of feel Adventure Time, but maybe more Voltron, which is
has
a huge fan following at our sister network, AfterBuzz TV. And I'm wondering
if... Check out the After Show.
Check out the After Show. We get guests on all the time. It's awesome. But I'm wondering, Steve, if, like, any of those shows inspire you or influence you. And I'd also love for you to speak on sort of this new emerging version of animated television that's kind of targeted for children, but also for adults.
Yeah. So, for sure. So... for one, I think a lot of the original inspirations for Buddy Thunder came from almost early anime I watched in the 80s that came to the States, like Space Battleship Yamato, which was Star Blazers over here, Mysterious Cities of Gold, The Little Prince, Belle and Sebastian, which was a cartoon, not the band, that were aired on like Nickelodeon, and then stuff like Transformers and Mask and all that stuff I kind of grew up with. But yeah, so stuff like Steven Universe and Adventure Time, which are both fantastic shows, and Voltron, I think more so, this kind of fits more with that maybe than Steven Universe or Adventure Time. It's I'm so happy, especially with Voltron, because I think, you know, Avatar The Last Airbender was years ago that aired. I think that was a fantastic show that... like you said, was just as much for adults as it was for teens and kids, and really touched on some awesome themes, and it made room for song and poetry and other stories within that universe. I couldn't be more thrilled now that a show like Voltron is so successful. And it's great. I mean, I think that could have gone south in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And they just did such a great job with that reboot. And Steven Universe and Adventure Time are also two of my favorites. That I don't know. They're just, like you said, they're working on so many different levels, as far as their humor goes. And I think is a big reason why they appeal to so many different demographics.
It's just so interesting to me because live action kids shows are like so clearly for children. Like you'll watch these animated or not animated, you'll watch these live action Disney multicam shows and it's like, this is so clearly designed for someone who's like 12 years old. Whereas with these animated shows, it just doesn't feel like they're constrained by those same limits. And do you feel like, as sort of an expert on this genre, can you point to any reason why it works so different in that medium?
Oh man. I would not necessarily claim to be an expert, but
a fan at least.
I don't know. I don't know why. I mean, something like Voltron is playing at least a little bit on nostalgia. But Steven Universe and Adventure Time, I guess to some extent also is appealing to some nostalgia, but they don't, for whatever reason, I don't know if it's budgetary thing or what, but the writing on those shows, it just doesn't dumb it down as much as, like you said, some of the live action shows do. I do want to point out that there was a kick-ass Kickbot. Can I say that?
Yeah. You can say whatever the hell you want.
Live action show on Amazon called Gordimer Gibbons' Life on Normal Street, which is one of the few shows I think that adults and live action shows that adults and teens can enjoy. But yeah, so I don't know what it is. They take more chances, and I don't know if that's, you know, I'm not sure why exactly. I don't know.
There seems to be a shift in live action for children that wasn't there, at least when I was a kid. Because I know when I was a kid, it was something, when I go back and look at even movies that I watched as a kid, there are jokes in Jumanji that went over my head as a child that I understand as an adult.
Yeah.
And there was, a better understanding that you can have a show be for the child and the adult and across all realms for any type of child television or child movies that they've kind of lost in the live action arena, but it's still been able to be maintained in the animated arena because adults like animated things. And so we're still going to be attracted to that, even with like our adult, you know, Rick and Morty or
Family Guy,
Adventure Time or so they can still kind of have that arena because they know adults are still tuning in for that. And I feel like they've lost that a little bit with the live action arena.
Yeah, and adults like to watch animated shows with their kids.
Exactly.
On top of it. Well, so parents get enjoyment out of it as well, and it's not...
They haven't forgotten that adults in that area, but live action, I think especially after like Hannah Montana, I was like, okay, this is not... this is not for me.
Okay, kind of changing topics a little bit. A lot of the writers that come in here, they'll say to us like, oh, yeah, I definitely see somebody like a Kristen Wiig for this role, or they have a clear image that matches both the look and the voice. You were very descriptive in your script with people's appearances, and I was wondering if when writing this you heard certain voices because you really can play around with that so much more since you don't have to match their appearance.
That's a great question. You know, I didn't. I didn't write it with any specific actors in mind.
Or even like voice types. Were you writing this and you were like, this person's going to be squeaky and mousy, and this person's going to be...
Yeah. That as far as, you know, like, you know, Radial Jones, the guy that runs the Outer Limits Lift Deck Shop, you know, I kind of like a more deep and gravelly kind of voice. And but outside of that, outside of the few more, a few of the more, you know, I guess again, not for the most part, I didn't really, I mean, I heard them in my head, I suppose. But really, no, that whatever actors would be able to do the roles justice, as you guys all did. I want to say that.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Is this the first time you've ever had this table read?
It is. So it was... Go ahead, bud.
I was going to say, I always like to follow that question up with, if it is the first time, is there anything that you liked or didn't like or changed or things that worked for you or, you know?
No. You guys all elevated it, really. You did such an awesome job. And I guess having heard it, and I think... So I started acting a couple years ago, initially as a way to kind of bolster my writing. And between that and hearing it here today, there's probably some dialogue changes I would make. I always read my stuff out loud and would encourage people to do that, you know, to myself. But I never looked at the dialogue and acted it. And as I got more into acting and stuff like that, I think there's a lot I would maybe be even more economical with some of the dialogue. But otherwise, not really. You guys did such a great job with the pacing too. Like that was really cool to hear the pacing, and see that come to life.
Yeah, it's paced really well, and all those things with the action will be, you know, those will happen like that as opposed to over the course of a minute and a half of reading like a page, you know.
Right.
I'm really curious about this show, this going beyond season one, because you said there were a lot of mysteries and you said that they were going to be mostly answered. So do you think beyond season one, it's going to be a through-line mystery each season? Is that kind of the idea, or will it always focus around Buddy Thunder?
Buddy Thunder is always involved. He will always be a part of it. But the second and third seasons do change a bit. There's this whole antagonist that that's attached to that kind of churning blackness that's in the prologue that plays a bigger role later in the series and in the second and third seasons also. So I guess it gets a little bit bigger or cinematic. It's not a very specific term, but there is this this kind of nomadic civilization that's working its way into the solar system that we start to see as season one goes on. They play a larger role in season two. Buddy grows up a lot. There's kind of this big, not war necessarily, but there's a lot more that happens as far as this other antagonist that comes into the picture.
Interesting.
Cool.
Steve, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you. Do you have any questions for us?
I don't think so. Not that I can think of. So when you guys read this, because it was so interesting to hear your choices as far as the kinds of voices and things you did, is there anything you guys can say about how those came to you? Or so many of them were spot on, which is why I ask. And, you know, what kind of, you know, when you guys are looking at script, and not just with this one, but with any of the ones that you guys have done, you know, how do you arrive at your choices for portraying those characters?
I mean,
it must be hard. I mean, you probably don't have a lot of time with the script. I mean, you're doing a cold read. So to be able to do that on the fly, how do you do that? I guess that's a question for any of you.
I was going to make a joke about reading the action, but I'll let our actors speak.
We'll save everyone from that.
Yeah, no, I think sometimes it is in the description of the character, and sometimes it's what you interpret, how they would deliver this dialogue, or how, like, just judging by how they're responding to another character, and you go, oh, okay, that sounds kind of sarcastic, or, oh, this guy sounds kind of like, like surfer douche. and so, sorry, do people still say douche? So you kind of just go off of what, a lot of the times it's going off of the dialogue, and then, because sometimes in the writing of the description of the character, the writer won't necessarily have it completely fleshed out, or they'll have, like, an idea, but you're like, actually, I see what you're saying, but I think this is actually what they're more like. And so you kind of, like, try and do a merge of the two.
Yeah, for me, it's always just an image, a mental image of this character. And then along with the language that you use, like, some people say ain't, some people say comma ha, and they have these interesting little nuances that I think help create the voice and the picture and everything.
Yeah, I try to. We actually had a conversation about this before the show started, and I was like, "Guys, what are you guys thinking about for Cantaloupe's voice? Like, this is what I'm seeing." And then Jeff was like, "I think a little nerdier," and Drew was like, "Kind of like this," and I was like, "Oh!" And then it reminded me of the Claw from Toy Story, and then that's where I went with that.
Yeah.
So, like, weird ways like that, I guess.
Everyone has, like, a different way of doing it. Yeah. Sometimes it reminds you of a different character, and so you just do, like, your take on that character.
Yeah.
Like, from a different. Mm-hmm.
And then every time, like, when there was a long break before it in my head before, I think, like, oh, the Claw moves, and then you speak the words that are actually there with that in your mind. Mm-hmm. That was me. I don't know if that helps. If that answered your question. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just so cool to hear what you guys bring to the characters, which is something, you know, you had asked as far as after hearing it. And I think that's something, like, going forward that I try to do with projects is trust the actors a little bit, you know, more as far as what they can bring to the role.
We have a group of very, very talented actors here, and I'm so grateful for them every week. And just so you guys know, we're here every Friday, either at 9 a.m. or 10 a.m. You can hear amazing other projects. Steve, thank you so much for being here with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I had a great time. So, good. And if anybody wants to you know, read more about Buddy Thunder or any of my other projects, you can just go to my website. They're all up there. So
perfect. What's your website again?
It's just my name, steveandriolo.com. So if you Google me, it'll come up.
Yep. Just so for our audio listeners, Andriolo is spelled A-N-D-R-I-O-L-O. Steve Andriolo.
Steve is S-T-E-V-E.
Thank you, Roxy.
You're welcome.
Steve, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah. Great. Thank you guys so much.
All right. We'll talk soon. We'll be in touch. Bye.
Bye.
Bye, Steve. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been the Unproduced Table Read here on the Popcorn Talk Network. As I mentioned, we have shows every week. So we're here every Friday at 9 a.m. for movies or 10 a.m. for pilots. And we read just about everything. I mean, today we read an animated comedy. Sometimes we're reading dark thrillers. Sometimes we're reading female-driven historical period pieces. That'll be next week. I'm super excited about it. But if you liked today's show, I would highly recommend an episode we read called Dream Ship. It's another sort of kid-driven adventure story, so I would definitely recommend that episode.
I love that one.
Yeah, it's really fun. It's kind of a swashbuckling... Uh-oh, our door is opening. What's happening right
We're
now?
Haunted.
We're haunted.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Roxy.
So cute.
Happy birthday to you.
Just so you guys know, it's Roxy's birthday. Roxy, you got your Skittles because it's your favorite.
Yeah, you gotta blow your candles.
Yeah, you gotta make a wish, girl.
I don't even know what the yellow Skittles are. What are yellow Skittles?
Bright sides.
Holy crap.
I know that is.
Okay.
All right.
Hey. It's easy when you wish for the same thing every time.
Nice. So, guys, thanks for tuning in. Again, we read Buddy Thunder today, children's driven adventure story. We've got some other ones of those on the podcast, so check those out. My name is Jeff. If you guys want to find me online, you can do that at Jeffrey C. Graham.
You guys can find me everywhere at Andrew Guy. Thanks, Steve, and happy birthday, Rox.
Thank you. I'm Roxy Stryer. You guys can find me at Roxy Stryer.
Happy birthday, Rox. We love you. I am Timothy Michael. You can find me everywhere at I am Timothy Mike.
Happy birthday, Rox, because we're all going to say it.
Yeah.
Follow me on.
Because otherwise, you seem mean.
Right? You follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Miss Adrienne Snow.
Happy birthday, Rox. I'm Sheldon White. You can find me on all social media at Sheldon White 2.
Oh, kiwi banana?
Yeah.
Kiwi banana. At that.
And right. With that, guys, thanks for being here. We'll see you next week here on the Unproduced Table Read. Bye.
Bye, guys.
Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network. We would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
Views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.